ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In well-functioning societies, the likes of Ireland, Canada and Australia, for instance, there are rules governing the way people drive. You know, don't drive on the wrong side and don't run a red light. We take them for granted, but they're important because letting people just drive the way they want to... yeah, not such a good idea. There are similar rules about the way people behave in society, what's considered acceptable. Think defamation and the laws against physically or verbally assaulting others. At a macro level, it's just about getting along when there's approximately 8 billion of you trying to inhabit the one tiny planet. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Now, the comparison between the rules of the road and the rules of social behaviour isn't a perfect one, because in the social sphere, there's lots of room for interpretation. And as we know, there are sometimes moments when even two of the most politically powerful people in the world think they have a right to behave in a manner that many would consider a breach of the way things ought to be done.
Military, and do you think that it's respectful to come to the Oval Office of the United States?
You're in no position to dictate what we're going to feel. We're going to feel very good.
Let's not dwell there. Suffice it to say that today's Future Tense is about getting a better understanding of the notion of civility. Can we operate effectively in a future world that appears to be becoming increasingly uncivil? And we'll also find out about a globally focused initiative that's aimed at trying to recognise and promote good social interaction.
So the Sociable Cities Project is devoted to the study of sociable interactions in public spaces and the importance of public spaces as spaces of encounter that support interactions across social differences and that cultivate healthy cities. The social life of the city can often be easily missed. And we would argue we need to pay attention to the things that work well in society, not just when things fall apart.
Designing for civility. That's Sara Lienemar, and we'll hear more from her shortly.
It's a pretty common experience for people to feel that everywhere we look, we see violations of conventions of appropriate behavior, and that common courtesy is no longer common. But we always see that problem as external to our own behavior. We witness it in the actions of others when we're driving on the road, or when we're shopping, or when we're online. We can easily spot the people that we consider to be rude or offensive. My name is Keith Bybee, and I am Vice Dean and Professor of Law and Political Science at Syracuse University.
And let me be the first to put up my hand and say that even I have been guilty of the phenomena Professor Bybee just described, ignoring my own, at times, uncivil behaviour. So let's just put that on the record.
You know, one of the definitions of a con artist is he robs us of the belief that it's only good people who have good manners, right? And vice versa, that it's bad people who have bad manners. No, you can have ways of treating other people and has nothing to do with your own moral scale, and maybe a little bit because you're willing to treat other people poorly, but you can separate, you can compartmentalize the way in which you interact with somebody publicly and what you actually think about them privately. It's a very common trope in Hollywood movies and in stories where the most well-mannered person is actually quite nefarious. It's the villain who has scrupulous manners. Being polite does not mean that you are actually kind. Civility, politeness, courtesy, all these standards of appropriate behavior, which bear a relationship to each other, although they are distinct, are matters of outward display. It's a matter of me showing you respect. We can interact civilly with others because we are actually ourselves. moral, gracious individuals that are granting due respect to people that we recognize are human beings with dignity and rights. Or you might be treating somebody civilly just because you want to get ahead. Civil behavior is a matter of action. It is consistent with moral aspiration, but you need not be a moral person in order to behave civilly. You need only to conform to conventions of appropriate behavior. And I think that that's actually a good thing. If you think of our situation really being, and by that I mean like the conditions of modernity, which is we live in large heterogeneous communities where people disagree, and they disagree on all kinds of things, including ultimate values, then yet we must find ways of interacting with one another because we are dependent upon one another, even if our ideas of justice and our interests do not coincide or align. So we need to have a mechanism that allows us to interact without requiring each one of us to like or love one another, or without requiring all of us to be actually virtuous moral individuals.
So yes, civility can be a good thing because it helps reduce friction in society. But we shouldn't mistake civility for moral virtue. And according to Professor Bybee, it's arguably a beneficial thing that conventions around civility leave a lot of wriggle room, as I said earlier.
When we think about law, it's something that's authoritatively determined according to a specified process. So we know something is a law for people in the community to obey, not because I've just said it or you've just said it, but because duly elected individuals have followed the process for passing that law, and it has been promulgated and enforced according to pre-established rules. We have institutions in place that we call courts of law that tell us what to do when there's a dispute over what the law means. We lack all that typically in the case of civility. That lack of governing and regulating institutions in the case of good manners has led people, on occasion, to want to make civility more like law and to determine codes of conduct that can be enforced by authoritative institutions. That can work if we're talking about a small group or club or organization of people. They can identify their own conventions of appropriate and respectful behavior. But when we do that or attempt to do that on a larger scale and do it in society as a whole, we run into all kinds of problems. There are hundreds of times each day when you encounter others, when there is an opportunity to behave civilly or uncivilly. And if your ability to live up to some kind of shared standard now becomes kind of a question of law and something for which you can be taken to task, maybe even fined or imprisoned on the basis of your inability to adhere to these prevailing conventions, then we will have kind of thrown out the baby with the bathwater. We will have rectified the problem of having multiple civilities. At the same time, we would have killed social life.
There is a notion that's popular that at this particular point in history, we're at a crisis or in a crisis of civility. It's a popular narrative, but it suggests, doesn't it, that there was a time when things were much more civil. You don't buy that, though, do you?
No, I don't. You're absolutely right. In a lot of current discourse, discussion, arguments about civility today, one of the sometimes unstated assumptions, but often frequently expressed premises of those discussions and arguments is that there was a golden age. The timing of this golden age tends to differ depending on the age of the speaker, but that there was a time when people behaved appropriately and that people in everyday ordinary life treated each other with respect. They might disagree with one another, but they weren't disagreeable. And present day is presented as a kind of falling away. We've been cast out of the Eden of this golden age where civility was widely understood and universally practiced into this culture of conflict. The trouble with that easy assumption that there was a golden age is that once you look at history, you'll find that every generation complained about the decline of standards of appropriate behavior, and they had no difficulty at all locating causes of that decline in their own time. So today, for example, we might blame social media as an engine for generating disrespectful treatment of one another. We might add to that political polarization. We can certainly find causes of incivility in our own time. But as we look backwards, we can see people blaming incivility on rock music, on immigration, on the vulgar rich or the insolent poor. Literally, every generation has complained about the loss of civility. It's because every generation finds itself in the same position with regard to civility. If you live in a society that's dynamic, that is growing and changing, that has people with different interests and ideas, you're going to have conflict, but you're also going to have different experiences growing up, different understandings about what constitutes respectful or appropriate behavior. And when you enter society with these different ideas, you're going to create the experience that there is no civility, that, as I said, common courtesy is no longer common, but it's never been fully common or universally agreed upon and universally applied in any society that has any dynamism to it.
And there's been a very dark side to the notion of civility in past times. Professor Bybee points out that in his country, the United States, allowing black people to eat in the same restaurants and use the same toilets as white people was once considered the very height of incivility, of inappropriate behaviour in southern states. And at the beginning of last century, women, remember, like children, were meant to be seen and not heard. A woman having and sharing opinions in public, well, again, without overstressing the point, civility can be used in both a good and a bad way. But what about incivility? Is it ever good? Author Rafi Cohan calls it trash talk, and he argues we simply don't take it seriously enough.
There is a real history to trash talk. There is a science to trash talk in terms of the psychological pathways by which it operates. And there's also, of course, moral and ethical considerations that should be taken into account as well. But all of which is to say that there's some real depth to the idea of trash talk, whereas from a sort of broadly cultural perspective, we think about it as something that is sort of easily dismissed, something that is gratuitous to the game or gratuitous to the task at hand. And as a result of that, I think we misunderstand what's really happening, right? We take trash talk at its word, as opposed to looking underneath the surface and understanding how it's really operating.
And part of the reason we've often underestimated it in the past, says Rafi Cohan, is because it's deployed to entertain as much as manipulate. Just think back to the self-proclaimed greatest boxer of all time, Muhammad Ali.
If you think I whoop Sonny Liston, you wait till I get George Foreman. He talks too much, he's ugly, he's pretending, I'm the true champion, and they make me the underdog. I'm gonna show them all they're wrong because I'm the champion. I'm the real champion. There'll never be one like
me. When someone talks trash, you know, you are inviting a response in some ways, right? Trash talk at its core is the presentation of a challenge. You're suggesting in one form or another that your opponent doesn't have what it takes to succeed. The follow-up question to that is, can you handle that, right? Can you sort of respond in the appropriate way? In fact, and when I interviewed referees, NBA referees and NFL referees, about how they defined what was good for a game or what was bad for a game, specifically through the lens of trash talk, they told me that more than anything, what they would look at is the response of the target. How is the person going to retaliate, or are they going to retaliate, whether that's verbally or physically? Because once you start to escalate, then we start getting into, you know, a kind of incivility spiral, really, right? Because the only way is to go higher. If you're going to say something and I want to come over the top with an insult of my own, I can only raise the stakes. I'm not going to be de-escalating. So that's when, you know, a referee would have to step in. And so I think that is just another illustration of why the response is so critical and why each of us sort of, therefore, whether we're the trash talker or the trash talkee, have a critical role to play in terms of what this trash talk really means.
And is it the same in, say, politics as it is in sport? I mean, is it in politics, is it a way of getting a measure of your opponent?
I think it can be. Trash talk can take on a lot of different forms in politics. It can be used in a lot of different ways. The obvious example, of course, is Donald Trump. We can see Donald Trump, for example, going all the way back to the 2016 Republican primary debate stage when he was, you know, insulting and putting down his Republican rivals for the nomination. And I think in that sense, there is a little bit of gamesmanship, mental gamesmanship going on, trying to get them on his term, seeing how they'll respond. But I want to draw a critical distinction in the sense that there's also an audience in that sense, right? Whereas if you and I are just playing chess or playing a game of basketball one-on-one and there's no one else around, it's almost entirely upon my response to help define and shape, you know, the character of that trash talk. But once you introduce a wider and even national or global audience, then I think you lose control of that a little bit more because people can have their own interpretations and the response is not just defined by, you know, the individual in that moment, but it starts to go wider. But what I also wanted to say is that, you know, you can see trash talk in terms of being used at rallies as a way to sort of, you know, increase in-group identification or, you know, by putting out them versus us, the outsiders versus the insiders. You can see it in terms of almost the way a coach would use it in bulletin board material in a locker room, riling up the team, you know, go out there and creating motivation. So I think it's a little bit more strategic in terms of the way it's being used specifically to that wider audience as opposed to just taking the measure of your opponent.
It's easy to see the benefits of competitive hostility, as you call it, rightly or wrongly. What's the social cost, though? Is it possible to know?
So from a moral philosophy perspective, one of the questions about trash talk is whether it is essential or extraneous to the competition, right? Is this part of the activity that we're engaged in here? And those who are for it would say absolutely yes. In addition to the pursuit of athletic excellence, we're also wanting to test someone's mental fitness, someone's mental commitment to the game. Those who are against it would say, no, it's wrong to insult someone on the sports field for the same reason it's wrong to insult someone on the street. It's just you're demeaning someone in a way that is morally wrong. I think what's interesting about trying to take the measure of the cost is that what happens now, more so than ever, is that we lose the context in which it takes place. And what I mean by that is as technology is intruding on our play spaces, on our pitches and our courts and our fields, is that we are taking trash talk from the competitive environment, from, you know, the professional sports place, and we're removing it from that context and observing it from beyond. And I think that kind of competitive hostility can have a different meaning without the context. That doesn't necessarily excuse it, but I think it's an interesting aspect in terms of taking the measure of that wider societal cost is that due to technology, due to the volume, the scale and speed at which information spreads now and incivility can spread now, there is a deeper cost that should be taken into consideration.
Rafi Kohan there. And I have to confess, I love the title of his latest book. It's called Trash Talk, the only book about destroying your rivals that isn't total garbage. And you're with Future Tense on ABC Radio National. I'm Anthony Fennell. Let's flip things around now. And rather than continue to focus on the things that promote incivility in our world, let's appreciate the structures and systems that keep it at bay. Cultural sociologist Sarah Lienemar.
So the Sociable Cities Project is devoted to the study of sociable interactions in public spaces and the importance of public spaces as spaces of encounter that support interactions across social differences and that cultivate healthy cities. The social life of the city can often be easily missed. And we would argue we need to pay attention to the things that work well in society, not just when things fall apart. So like you mentioned, there's so much emphasis on incivility. And it's those kind of interactions, those negative and often sometimes tragic interactions that people remember more. But really, our day-to-day life is full of these actually often pleasant interactions with others unknown to us when you move about the city.
You use the term civil inattention. Could I get you to explain what you mean by that?
Like generally, there's this idea that the smooth functioning, especially of urban life because of its proximity and density, requires this kind of agreed upon kind of mutual indifference, it's been called, so that we purposefully can't pay attention to others because it would be overstimulating, too distracting, it would be intrusive. So we follow this kind of logic of kind of respectful inattention in many ways. But our research finds that there's actually these many more moments of actually sociable kind of attention or interaction that exist in particular types of public spaces.
Such as?
So there's designated leisure spaces like public parks that are more intentionally structured for, say, fun and sociability, but they also exist in sidewalks, public squares, believe it or not, even public transit. We've looked at skate parks, dog parks, all of these like kind of really everyday spaces where you actually have opportunities for often very pleasant and affirming interactions with others, but they're kind of easy to go unnoticed. They might not seem that remarkable, but they are socially affirming.
Those public spaces then have a value that's not necessarily appreciated by the public in general. We don't tend to think of them as being a mechanism for the continuation of our society, do we?
No, we don't. And that's part of our big argument, is that in order to kind of have like a vibrant, healthy, and even respectful society, we need to have more open, diverse types of public spaces. So not just these kind of big, like kind of like feature spaces, but spaces where everyday people can kind of have encounters with others that can offer kind of unexpected sometimes opportunities for interaction, opportunities to try new things. There's this term that's circulating more and more, is that of social infrastructure. That refers to kind of the facilities, spaces, services, and networks that support the kind of quality of life and well-being of individuals and communities. So we need social infrastructure as much as we need actually physical infrastructure. So a lot of political debates might center on big infrastructure questions, but they mean physical infrastructure. But actually, like community health, urban health really requires these social opportunities and networks. And that's where kind of public spaces come in. A lot of people might think that to have a great city, you need these mega attractions and great entertainment. But actually, it's the quality and quantity of free and accessible public spaces, like things, spaces that are open, flexible, and that provide opportunities for a diversity of users and uses. That's what really kind of makes cities great.
You know, there's a perception that it's an angry world at the moment, that we're not being civil to each other. Is it going too far to say that perhaps some of that might be because of the design of our cities, our urban spaces, because of the way we haven't thought enough about the public realm?
I think we haven't put enough resources into the public realm. We have allowed private interests and concerns to often take over a much more open and diverse public realm, for sure. There's also, just like as a social researcher, I struggle with the idea that everyday interactions are full of, say, violence and aggression, because actually, like generally, our day-to-day life, we encounter very little conflict as we kind of move about our everyday business. But that doesn't get kind of studied in the same way, so it's not actually represented. And another concern right now that's kind of alongside the fear of public spaces or the concerns over the rise of kind of incivilities or other contexts, which our research is kind of interested in, which is responding to things like the so-called loneliness epidemic, a rise of, say, political tensions and divisions. And we do believe that more shared spaces and of various types can really provide outlets and alternatives. Just because there is something that helps to neutralize conflict, just proximity and amicable contact can really help reduce tensions.
Sarah Lienemar from the Sociable Cities Project. And she's also, I should mention, an associate professor at the University of Guelph in Canada. And finally today, why you should be polite to AI. I know that might seem a weird thing to say, but social roboticist Eduardo Sandoval argues being civil to artificial intelligence can only be of benefit to we humans. He's from the University of New South Wales.
From the point of view of a social roboticist like me, the way that we treat machines reflects how we treat other humans, and our values reflect on them. Let's remember that in the way that we design machines, it's not neutral. There is a philosophy behind the designs that we have. There is a reflection of our cultural values as well. And polite ways of expression will lead to more clear prompts for these AIs. And in the case of agents like Alexa, Siri, OK Google, there is a very interesting case for me, which is children interacting with these agents. Some studies suggest that children tend to overestimate the capability of these agents. But on the other hand, they also tend to adjust the politeness towards them. They tend to be still more polite towards humans compared with these voice agents. As a parent, we want our children to address other humans politely. And some of our children who have access to these agents at home, at school, and so on, tend to develop language skills when they interact with them. You know, they are an influence. Of course, human-human interaction is the most powerful, relevant interaction that we have. But these agents, particularly voice agents, have an influence in how the kids develop vocabulary, in how they communicate with other kids, with other adults, like other technologies, certainly tablets and computers also have an impact in how they develop this skill.
We know that these algorithms, machines, that they learn from the instructions, from the interactions that they have with humans. Is that another reason for being polite?
Yeah. In the large language models, they use text, terabytes and terabytes of text to train the systems. So whatever is in the text is used as a source for the output that you will get from them. I think when it's problematic is when the people, computer science students, for instance, can easily implement these large language models locally. The cultural biases that you get from the corpus of data that you use with the agent certainly has a strong effect in the output. That's why when we talk about large language models like ChatGPT, they are usually supervised. The parameters are controlled. All the companies tend to de-escalate any toxic behavior, try to keep the answers neutral. I don't know if you have tried to use unpolite language or being rude towards any of these generative AIs, but they tend to be very neutral, very calm. However, there is a disclaimer from OpenAI saying that sometimes these AIs can mirror the tone that you use when you are providing prompts to it. I think we should be careful what we use as an input for them.
So we should be polite because there are benefits, as you've pointed out, in being polite. But we should always remember that these are actually machines. These are not real humans we are interacting with.
Yeah, like what we are doing with other humans. You try to be polite and nice with other humans until you notice that that approach, that social approach is not working. However, politeness has been critical to keep societies around the world cohesive and functional. And it's a main characteristic of being human. So certainly the practice towards other entities, let's call them like that, will be healthy from my perspective, from the human side of the human-machine interaction.
Not every challenge to a convention of appropriate behavior is a profound challenge, but we do have periods in history where we can see that people have deep conflicts and disagreements about the kind of respect that we owe one another in public life. And in the crucible of these agreements, in the kind of through working out of the political conflict, that's when we end up with new sets of understandings about appropriate behavior. That's how new sets of good manners or a new understanding of good manners is inaugurated. Treating women like they just belong in the home and that they're almost children, that's no longer how we treat women as a matter of civil, respectful behavior. Treating Black people like they are somehow lesser or inferior to white people is no longer the conventional respectful treatment for people of different races in public life. So it's not crazy to feel like there's a deep crisis of civility. It is a crisis, but it's not a crisis in the sense that civility is ending. It's a crisis in a sense that there is a conflict over what the conventions of appropriate behavior ought to be.
Professor Keith Bybee from Syracuse University, bringing today's Future Tense to a close. Karin Zvanovits was the producer. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.